Fauci says the worst is yet to come. Birx assures that Trump is doing the job. And the country doesn't know what to think. We fear we may be losing our patience on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The chief White House correspondent for ABC News has a new book describing what it's like to watch Donald Trump up close.
The president's behavior is erratic, and he makes these wild swings. But I find it incredibly predictable. I almost seem like I know what he's going to do before he does it.
Plus, Lou Cannon is here to talk about the influence of John Sears, the Reagan strategist who died last week.
Mike Devers told me, he said, Ronald Reagan would not have been president if he had not hired Sears, and he wouldn't have been president if he had not fired him.
And Russ Feingold recalls what went into passing monumental campaign finance legislation 19 years ago this week, only to see it become defunct after Citizens United.
But what people knew they liked was that two senators, one Republican, one a Democrat, were not letting anything get in the way, no partisanship, nothing to get in the way of trying to stop the corruption of this system.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 322 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's startling to think that just 1 month ago, we were preparing for Super Tuesday, wondering where the battle for the Democratic presidential nomination would take us. And just 3 weeks ago, we were guessing the identity of Joe Biden's running mate. Now, such talk has vanished from newspapers and television. Who has time for delegate count when the death toll from the coronavirus escalates each day? Who can even focus on the remaining primaries when life as we know it, as we knew it, has completely changed? For some, of course, nothing has changed. President Trump is no longer out there holding campaign rallies and criticizing the press, but he doesn't have to. He can do it from his daily White House briefings.
It amazes me when I read the things that I read. It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative. It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post.
Here he was responding to CNN's Jim Acosta.
What do you say to Americans who are upset with you over the way you downplayed this crisis over the last couple of months? We have it very much under control in this country. The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA. It's going to disappear. It's like a miracle. It will disappear.
If you look at those individual statements, they're all true. Stay calm. It will go away. You know it is going away, and it will go away, and we're going to have a great victory. And it's people like you and CNN that say things like that, it's why people just don't want to listen to CNN anymore. And instead of asking a nasty, snarky question like that, you should ask a real question.
And to Paula Reed of CBS News.
So you tweeted, you said that the media wants the country to remain closed to hurt your odds.
No, I think the media, I think there are certain people that would like it not to open so quickly. I think there are certain people that would like it to do financially poorly because they think that would be very good as far as defeating me at the polls. And I don't know if that's so, but I do think it's so that there are people in your profession that would like that to happen. I think it's very clear. I think it's very clear that there are people in your profession that write fake news. You do. She does. There are people in your profession that write fake news.
And he's been tweeting about the incredible ratings he's been getting. Last Sunday, he retweeted this. President Trump is a ratings hit. Since reviving the daily White House briefing, Mr. Trump and his coronavirus updates have attracted an average audience of 8.5 million on cable news, roughly the viewership of the season finale of The Bachelor. Numbers are continuing to rise. Some things never change. But the fact is, it's working. His approval ratings are higher than ever. A majority of Americans, including many Democrats, approve of the way he's handling the crisis. And there's not much Joe Biden can do about it. Plus, the recent emergence of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo as the Democrats' knight in shining armor has led some, those who should know better, to speculate that maybe the Democrats should rally behind Cuomo as their presidential nominee. That is not going to happen. Nominations, by the way, are won by delegate counts, not by people who march into a convention at the last minute.
Governor Adlai Stevenson escorted to the rostrum by President Truman.
I have not sought the honor you have done me.
Of course, that hasn't stopped Trump from having fun with it.
If he's going to run, that's fine. I wouldn't mind running against Andrew. I know Andrew for a long time. I wouldn't mind that. But I'll be honest, I think he'd be a better candidate than Sleepy Joe.
But for now, at least, politics in this country has come to a halt. Just try telling that to the President of the United States. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the McCain-Feingold bill, the one that curtailed the use of soft money in campaigns that was passed by the Senate in 2001. That also leads to this week's trivia question. Of all those in the Senate today who voted on that bill 19 years ago, who's the only one who voted against their party's position? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want.
If you're the chief White House correspondent for ABC News, as Jonathan Carl happens to be, your job is to ask questions of a president, especially in the midst of a global pandemic that seems to be getting only worse every day. In this instance, at a recent press briefing, President Trump is answering one of Carl's questions by describing what the administration is doing in filling the needs of those for ventilators.
We've distributed vast numbers of ventilators, and we're prepared to do vast numbers. I think we're in great shape. I hope that's the case.
Carl had a follow-up, and Trump was ready with an answer, kind of.
Everybody who needs one will be able to get a ventilator.
Look, don't be a cutie pie, okay? You know, everyone who needs one. Nobody's ever done what we've done. Nobody's done anything like we've been able to do. And everything I took over was a mess. It was a broken country in so many ways other than this. We had a bad testing system. We had a bad stockpile system. We had nothing in the stockpile system. So I wouldn't tell me what you tell, what, you know, like being a wise guy. Go ahead.
It may not have been the answer to Carl's question, but it's vintage Donald Trump. Self-congratulations, exaggeration of the facts, if not outright misstatements, and digs at his predecessor, as well as the press. It's the kind of answer Trump has been giving once he started taking the virus seriously. Jonathan Carl has had interactions with Trump for many years, going back to 1994. And he saved many of them up in a new book titled Front Row at the Trump Show. John, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
It's great to be here.
Well, you know, every morning when I pick up the New York Times or the Washington Post from my driveway, I'll go through a bunch of pages before my first, oh my God, escapes my lips. But with your book, I think I reacted that way on every page, whether it was something I've read before or something new that jumped out at me. But either way, it was nonstop OMGs.
Well, that's why I wrote this. I had experienced so much over the past 5 years, kind of mind-blowing events, my interactions with Donald Trump as a candidate, as a president, with the people around him. I felt like I needed to tell this story. This is a singular moment in American history. We've never seen a figure like him. I mean, literally, we never, of course, had a president who had no experience previously in government or in the military, and never anybody remotely like him in the way he operates, his method of doing business. So I wanted to get all of that. I wanted to get all of that down, and then the other vantage point here that was unusual for me is this is a guy that I first met 26 years ago when I was a young reporter for the New York Post, and I had some wild interactions with him back then. So I realized that I've known Donald Trump, covered him, but I've known him longer than anybody else in the press corps, but also in the White House press corps, but also longer than just about everybody on the White House staff, maybe everybody besides Ivanka. So I wanted to get this stuff down, and I wanted to be able to write it. I didn't want to go through things that you've already known. He's the most written about guy in the world, but only the things that I had a unique vantage point on, and that's what I focused this book on. And then I started doing the reporting for the book and talking to people and learning more about the incidents that I had witnessed, about what was going on behind the scenes, and I found people incredibly willing to talk to me and tell me things that blew my mind as I was doing the reporting.
Do you think he talks to you more than he talks to Ivanka, or there's no way of knowing that?
I don't know. It's a good question.
The funny thing, or the interesting thing about this book, is that when do you decide to start writing it or finishing it? Because, you know, in all the days since, or the weeks or whatever, the months since you finished writing the book, there's 8 million other stories you could have put in.
I know. One of the things that was the most difficult, I mean, from the start, and it froze me for a time from writing it, was where do you end it? Where do you end this damn thing? So I came up with a few ideas. One idea was, well, end it as he's off running for re-election. Okay. But then things happen and I experience more things. I'm like, so I had this incredible moment with him that I describe in the epilogue of my book, where he brings me into the Oval Office to basically chew me out over a story I had written. And there were a couple other things that happened right around that time, and I was like, this is the end point. This is great. The impeachment process was just starting, and I had that moment with Mick Mulvaney where he acknowledged the quid pro quo and then came out and denied he acknowledged the quid pro quo. So it enabled me to kind of hit on impeachment without diving into all of it. I was never going to be able to do that and get this book out anytime soon. But it just seemed like a logical end point. And there were times once it was done where I got really nervous because the book is out of your hands. You can't make any more changes. They're starting to print it. And impeachment, you know, is going forward, the Senate trial, all this stuff. And I really don't touch on any of that. I mean, I guess I just really pretty much in the epilogue. So I was nervous about that. And then impeachment happens and the whole country's sick of it. It ends with a predictable conclusion. And my book comes out just as the COVID-19 crisis hits. And actually, I think, oddly, it actually is so much more relevant to the current crisis than it would have been if it had come out in the midst of impeachment.
Would you describe yourself as amazed of what you've been watching, or not surprised, or both? Amazed, and maybe you're amazed and it's business as usual.
You know, I am... I find myself now, and I believe I've been at this point for a while, where the president's behavior is erratic, and he makes these wild swings, but I find it incredibly predictable. I almost seem like I know what he's going to do before he does it. I feel like I can kind of channel him to a degree, despite all that kind of wild unpredictability. It actually ends up being a predictable unpredictability. You know he's going to swing from one to the other, and you know what's going to be important to him. So, yeah, I am amazed. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to wake up from a dream and like, wow, what was that? You know, did that really happen? But it's been a fascinating ride as a reporter because, you know, the thing that you thrive on covering news is things that that you don't know are going to happen. So, you know, Donald Trump throws out all convention, usually covering a White House. It's the beat that many reporters aspire to. And then once you get there, you find it's really dull because presidents are very cautious. You have an interagency process. You have a national security process. It goes through, and by the time a decision gets to the president, it's been, vetted 10 times. The rollout is all carefully orchestrated, and all that's out the window with Trump.
Yeah, I was going to say, look, I've talked to White House correspondents for decades now. I mean, and they've all complained about the lack of access, the lousy working conditions, dealing with a president who doesn't trust the media. Donald Trump is not the first president who didn't like the media, but this feels different. I don't know. It just feels different.
Well, I mean, look, Obama complained bitterly about the White House press corps. His people complained about me and very, you know, I mean, they felt that the press corps didn't focus on the important stuff, that they're only focused on the negative stuff that was screwed up, ignored accomplishments. These are routine complaints that go back to George Washington, you know. But there is something different about Trump actually coming out and, you know, the phrase enemy of the people is. It has a connotation, which I have a whole chapter on that phrase and the way it was used.
Stalinesque.
It's Hitler. Hitler used it. Of course, it was popularized in the Reign of Terror in the French Revolution. It has a morbid and bloody history. I'm not saying that Donald Trump knows that history, but he certainly heard about it after he started saying enemy of the people, and he still uses the phrase.
But it's still, you know, what fascinates me about your book and the process itself is that this love-hate relationship he has with the press. I mean, he'll flatter you, he'll praise your work, and then he'll call you out at a rally as an enemy of the people. And, of course, the crowd gets, you know, hooping and hollering, you know, with their reactions to, you know, the CNN sucks kind of stuff. But that's what's amazing. I mean, he'll tell you to your face that you're doing great stuff and you're a great reporter, and then, boom, when you're outside in a rally, climb under a desk for your life.
He called you Michel Cinder a really good reporter in the very same tirade where he was, ridiculing her and insulting her. He goes back and forth often in sometimes in the same sentence. So I describe a scene in the book where I was at a rally in Fort Myers, Florida, in the press pen on the floor of the arena. Had nearly 10,000 people there, completely packed with Trump supporters, and just 3 minutes into the speech, I find the entire crowd is turning towards me and the other reporters in that press area and booing at us and hissing at us and chanting, you know, CNN sucks becomes kind of like the generic chant for everybody, but in a really vile and almost foreboding way. And that's not really an unusual experience that happens at a lot of Trump rallies. But what was weird about this one is I had just been backstage with Donald Trump. I had done an interview with him backstage at this rally. And the interview was fine. It was a short interview. It was pretty contentious, but he was happy with it. And he wasn't upset with him. He was in a good mood. And he says, come with me after the interview. And he goes and he brings me to another room backstage. And Ron DeSantis and his wife is back there. Rick Scott and his wife back there.
Ron DeSantis, the new governor of Florida, and Rick Scott, the new senator, governor turning senator, right?
At the time, they were both candidates. This was right before the midterm elections in 2018. And he brings me into the room and says, everybody, I want you to meet the great Jonathan Carl, the great guy, ABC News. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of, you know, but he's done this before. I've seen this before. And he turns to me first in front of them and says, are you going to come and watch my speech? Are you going to come out? And I say, of course. I mean, that's, you know, I'm a reporter. I'm here. Yeah. He says, you got to come watch my speech. You got to be out. It's going to be a great one. You're going to come. And three times he says, are you going to come and watch my speech? And I said, yes, yes. And then I went out to watch the speech. And then about 5 minutes later, you know, he's got the crowd riled up and chanting and leering, you know, in my direction. I mean, just totally bizarre.
The far left media has spread terrible lies and stories about the Trump administration and the tens of millions of people who make up our great movement, the greatest political movement in the history of our country. The greatest. The greatest.
Here's a question. You're not only the ABC News chief White House correspondent, you're the head of the White House Correspondents Association. So I guess my question is, and I think this is part of the bigger question, but there's a lot of misinformation given out at these briefings. I mean, when Anthony Fauci or Deborah Birx is speaking, that's one thing. But when Trump is speaking, it's self-congratulations. You know, I'm doing an amazing job. I deserve a 10. And then he'll say things like, well, you know, everything will get better. Let's go back to normal. Let's flood the churches by Easter Sunday. As somebody who, you I'm talking about here, who plays a big role in the disseminating of information, what happens when there's so much misinformation, especially at a time when misinformation could become deadly?
Well, it's a challenge. It's been the challenge of covering this White House from the beginning, is that you hear so many things from official sources, especially the top official source, that are not true and that have to be corrected. And you have to give context. But as you point out now, we're at a point where you have a national crisis, and the credibility of the information coming out of the White House is you know, can be a question of life or death. So there's a debate raging over whether or not these briefings should be covered live. I don't, you know, fortunately, that's not something that I have to, it's above my pay grade. I do hear others argue that we shouldn't even cover the briefings at all. On that, I say that's ridiculous. You know, we're White House reporters. My job is to cover what the president's doing, to ask him the question, to if I have access to the people on the task force, to ask them questions, to learn what the government is doing, what it is not doing, what it should be doing. That's our job. But that's different from whether or not these should be carried unfiltered and without any, you know, just live. You know, you're raising, actually, I'll word the question a little differently, maybe a little harshly, but sometimes you ask the question, is it safe to air, is it safe, is it responsible to air the words of the President of the United States?
Isn't that something?
I mean, just think about that. You could actually have a debate about that, a legitimate debate about that. So I think it's important what he says and what he does, but you've got to provide the context. And we've carried the briefings live occasionally, very rarely from gavel to gavel. But I did George Stephanopoulos was anchoring the special report. You know, I came on right after Trump was done, and we had to spend the next 10 minutes basically correcting things that were said at the briefing. Either me or Dr. Jen Ashton, our medical reporter. We were it's a very odd situation. It's like, no, actually, no, 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 and no.
Oh, no. Oh. Well, here's another thing, and I was, you know, because I watched most of these as well. There was a question the other day from this person, and I wouldn't call her a reporter, from One American News Network, OAN. And she actually asked him if he thought the term Chinese food was racist because, you know, he's been saying that COVID-19 is a Chinese virus, and he's been accused of racism there. So she wanted to know if Chinese food was racist. And then she went on and on about all the left-wing reporters in the room who mouth Chinese propaganda.
I think she actually suggested that we were somehow tied to ISIS and Mexican gang.
Right. Why not? But, I mean, you as the head of the White House Correspondents Association, you have no say in allowing that person from another planet to come to a briefing and ask that kind of question.
Well, we don't control access to the building, no. We do control who sits, who has assigned seats in the briefing room. And, you know, that's something that the White House Correspondents Association was started in 1914 because Woodrow Wilson was holding press conferences and there were, you know, some shady people that were coming to these things and violating the rules. And he said, I'm going to stop having them unless you can get control over it. So the correspondents gathered together to basically be the credentialing body. We don't do the credentialing anymore, but we do control the seating. OAN does have a shared seat in that briefing room. Right now it means, because of the way it's scaled back, their turn for that seat comes up basically once every 9 days. It's a very unusual situation for us to be in because I don't want to be in the position of throwing somebody out because they ask inane questions. But that one really, and there have been some others from them that have really been something else.
Let me ask you a semantic question. I don't mean to be anti-semantic, but let me ask you this question. When the president says something that we know is not true, or that his health advisors are saying that may not be true, I mean, do we call them misstatements? Do we call them lies? I know you're very careful about the press being seen as the enemy or the opposition, but when he's saying things that are clearly not true, what's the language we use?
I tend to not use the word lie, and here's why. And I have used it, but I tend not to use it because lie is a weighted term. It states the motive that it's knowingly untrue, as opposed to maybe he just didn't have the facts. I would rather have others make that judgment. And when I say the president's a liar or the president lied, roughly half, maybe 40-35% of the country who strongly supports him immediately tunes me out. And I don't think that's productive. So I just say, that's not true. Here's the truth. That's a misstatement. That's wrong. And I asked him, it's actually in that same interview in Fort Myers, Florida. I was asking him about his relationship with the truth, because he actually made a promise in the campaign. It's kind of one of those forgotten campaign promises where he said, I will never lie to you. And I asked him about that, and I said, because you've just said things that I had five recent examples of things he said that were not true. And he said, well, I try to tell the truth. I try.
Well, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah. And it reminded me, I had a good friend named Scott Alexander, still a great friend in college, who said to me, and it just stuck with me for some reason, he said, like, I would never lie to you unless I had to. So I was like, wait a minute,
Excellent. Two quick questions. You've watched Trump for more than a quarter century, and I've heard you say that he has not changed. Has the press changed?
Well, the press has changed entirely. I mean, it's a whole different world from, when three broadcast networks and the major newspapers and the wire services were the dominant forces, and what you learned came through those very big and official channels. Now it's the explosion of online outlets, the ability of everybody to get on Twitter, and the way rumor spreads so quickly, and the gatekeepers are essentially gone. It's a very different atmosphere than it was even when I got into the business. My first job in television was with CNN, when it was the only cable news network. Not long after I started working at CNN, MSNBC went online and Fox News, but they were, much smaller audiences and took a while to get started. And, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no BuzzFeed.
There was no political junkie.
Yeah, there was no political, although somebody told me that you've been doing podcasts for longer than people like knew what podcasts were.
I did it during the McKinley administration. I've been starting since then.
There you go. It's excellent.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say all of America decides to read your book, which wouldn't be a bad thing for you.
No, that's good.
What changes? Does anything change?
I don't know. I mean, I would hope that, I wrote this as a story. I wrote this to be a compelling read, to give you insight into what Donald Trump is all about, but also to tell you what it has been like to cover this guy, this White House, to tell the story. I wasn't trying to, make a political point. I'm not trying to push people in one direction or the other. But I get very serious at the end of the book about my concern of what I call the war on truth, and the fact that we are now incredibly divided. That, as you well know, is not new in American history. But what I feel, what I worry about, is that we are at a point where people don't even have the same view of the truth, of facts, of what is real and what is not. Where half the country looks at a newspaper and doesn't believe a damn thing they see, you know, where the other half looks at the president of the United States and doesn't believe that he has any credibility no matter what he is saying. And, you know, if we don't have a basic agreement about what the truth is, then how are we going to have any prayer of overcoming our differences? And I wrote this before the COVID-19 crisis, obviously, but it's more stark now because it's, again, the credibility of this information, whether it's coming from what we call the mainstream media or coming from the top leaders in our federal government, you have to have an ability to at least believe that basic information is credible and to be able to trust that information. And you have people trusting different, entirely different sets of facts. It's the old Moynihan quote, but it's far more than Moynihan could have ever anticipated. You know, he said, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. Well, I mean, now we're at the point where people really do have their own facts.
Jonathan Karl is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and the author of the new book, Front Row at the Trump Show. It is the Trump Show, isn't it, John?
It really is. Thank you very much, Ken. Thank you for having me on.
Great having you on the program. Thanks so much.
Take care.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
One of the early architects of Ronald Reagan's rise to the presidency, John Sears, died last week at the age of 79. He was Reagan's campaign manager in 1976 when the former California governor challenged the unelected president of his own party, Gerald Ford, for the nomination. Reagan came close but ultimately failed. Sears also led the campaign 4 years later, the one that sent Reagan to the nomination and the White House. But on the day of the New Hampshire primary, when Reagan romped to a crucial win over rival George Bush, Sears was fired by the candidate himself. He never got to share in the 44-state landslide Reagan won in November over President Carter. Lou Cannon remembers all that. He was a senior White House correspondent for the Washington Post during the Reagan presidency and the author of numerous books on Reagan, including President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime, and Governor Reagan, His Rise to Power. Lou now lives in California, where he's currently a columnist for the StateNet Capital Journal, a weekly political publication. Lou, it's great to hear your voice again.
It's good to hear yours, Ken, and it's sort of bittersweet to be reminiscing about somebody I knew well and who hasn't been on the political scene for a long time and who unfortunately passed away of a heart attack recently.
John Sears was one of those early strategists working to get Reagan elected. And, you know, people point out that he was fired early in the 1980 campaign. But in 1976, Reagan came close to winning the nomination. And Sears' decision to throw the dice by naming an early running mate was one of the boldest moves of the campaign. Talk a little bit about that.
Sears knew, I think, he had kept up a pretty good game with the press that Reagan had enough delegates or might have enough delegates to beat Ford at the Republican convention.
Well, he was certainly close. He was only about a handful or a dozen or so away, right?
Well yeah, and what he thought was, and there were many of these delegates that were from Pennsylvania, and who expressed that they were undecided. Now, I don't know that they were undecided. I talked to many of them, and I think some of them just, President Ford would call them in, and they'd get a trip to the White House and, you know, be wooed in the Rose Garden, and that was a big deal. But anyway, they professed a number of them to be undecided, and Sears had this idea, and it was a brilliant idea. I mean, it was certainly something that had never been done before, of having Reagan name a running mate.
In advance of the convention.
Yes, and he picked Richard Schweiker. Now, Schweiker was an interesting character. He was a senator.
A senator from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. And Schweiker had, he was unusual among Republican senators. It'd even be more unusual today. He had a pretty good standing with organized labor. And he was hoping, Sears was hoping in this, he was hoping several things. One, that it would pry some Pennsylvania delegates loose, and he was also hoping that they could force Ford's hand and get Ford to nominate, to say who he would have as his running mate, and neither of these things happened. But it did create an air of uncertainty around the nomination and going into the convention in Kansas City, and had won the presidency, I think he'd have had a good relationship with Stryker.
Well, let me play a little piece of tape from CBS's Walter Cronkite. I mean, that battle, you know, with Reagan naming Stryker as his running mate and trying to get Ford to do the same by announcing his own running mate, that was the big controversy and the excitement going into the convention. Here's Walter Cronkite.
There will be a vote tonight that both sides acknowledge will test their strength, which could make or break their candidate here. It will be on a change in the party rule. 16C is the number of that new rule proposed by the Reagan side that would force President Ford to name his vice presidential running mate by tomorrow morning, 12 hours before the presidential balloting is scheduled to begin.
But Lou, ultimately in the end, Pennsylvania Republicans weren't switching to Reagan. It didn't seem to work.
No, and I personally became persona non grata with Sears and all of the leadership, because we printed in the Washington Post beforehand, before the convention, thanks to a very good delegate count that a man named Steve Isaacs was doing for us, that he didn't have the votes. And it was always kind of a game that Sears was playing. He didn't have these people, and he knew it. But he fooled a lot of people there for a pretty long time. And Sears was also hoping, to be fair to John, he was also hoping that there would something would happen at the convention on the platform or something that would suddenly turn the convention. And Sears used to say, if they had a secret ballot at that convention, Reagan would have been nominated by a landslide, and that's probably true.
Well, you know something, I mean, let me go stick to that Richard Stryker gamble for a second. As you point out, it moved very few delegates, and you could hear this in Senator Hugh Scott's voice. Scott, of course, was the Senate Republican leader, and he was a big Ford backer, and he was the chairman of the Pennsylvania delegation. But I'm going to play a little piece of tape of Hugh Scott at the convention, and you could hear him all but gloating about how badly it failed. This was Scott during the roll call at the convention in Kansas City.
Madam Chairman, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, home of the Phillies and the Pirates, cast 10 votes for Governor Reagan and 93 votes for Gerald Ford.
And Lou, basically that sealed the nomination for Gerald Ford.
Yeah, the thing is, Scott and Stryker were, being from the same state, were political rivals. Neither had a use for each other, so Scott was sort of doubly happy. He was happy for Ford, but he was also happy to see, he thought, Stryker repudiated, although I don't think anybody blamed Stryker, and he proved, Stryker proved the next time he ran that he was still very well thought of by Pennsylvanians.
Did Sears take any blame for that, or was he congratulated for taking a gamble?
I think that everybody thought that it was a risky move, but a move worth taking. And none of the Reagan staff, Mike Deaver, Meese, they had plenty of complaints with Sears, but none of them faulted the Stryker move. That I can, maybe Lynn Nofziger did a little bit, because Lynn was very conservative and Stryker wasn't conservative enough for him. But Reagan thought it was worth the gamble, and I asked him about it afterward. In an interview him, and he said that it was a risk. We knew it was a long shot, but the point is, the reason that Sears wasn't criticized for this by people who didn't like him is that they were going to lose if they didn't. They had to do something, because Ford was just using the power of the White House and incumbency to really roll up the delegates. So if there had been no move, if Ford would have been proclaimed the winner long before the convention. And I think it was a very creative move. I mean, we haven't had anything like it before or since. And I had my own differences with Sears as a reporter. He tried to shut me out of things that I didn't think I should be shut out of. But I always thought the Schweiker gambit was a brilliant move on his part.
So let's fast forward to 1980. Sears again is the campaign chairman for the Reagan campaign manager for the Reagan campaign. On the day of the New Hampshire primary, this is a day of a great victory for Reagan over George Bush. Sears was fired that day, even before the vote came in. What did Sears do wrong in 1980?
Just about everything. First of all, Sears and Reagan were not that compatible to begin with. John was a strategist and a conceptualist, and a guy who knew all the, could tell you how precincts in obscure states had voted 20 years ago, and Reagan wasn't interested in any of that. But the real thing is that Sears was trying to conduct a coup. The Reagan old guard all felt that, and he got rid of Mike Deaver, which was a very, very, I think, foolish thing on John's part. Sears had been drinking. He'd been having some other problems. And Deaver was very important to Nancy Reagan and important to Ronald Reagan, too. Once Reagan once referred to him as a son he never had. He had sons, but I think he liked Deaver more. But in any case, what happened is that Sears was trying to pick them off one by one. And after Deaver was gone, Reagan developed a kind of a resentment for him. And they would have got rid of him earlier, except for this. In Iowa, where Reagan was favored, George Herbert Walker Bush had almost moved to Iowa and lived there. And he upset Reagan in the Iowa caucuses. I was covering that very carefully. And I wrote a story about how Reagan was sleepwalking in Iowa. And Paul Laxalt, the senator from Nevada and Reagan's closest ally and friend in the Congress, Paul had been governor of Nevada at the same time Reagan was governor of California. They were close. And Laxalt blew up. He said Laxalt blamed Sears, and he told Reagan you were sitting on your ass in Iowa and that you got to get busy and be on the ground in New Hampshire. He'd been treating Iowa as a kind of a flyover state and hoping that his reputation would get him by. Reagan, who sometimes was accused of not working very hard, really worked his tail off in New Hampshire. And he was well ahead of Bush long before the Sears firing. They had talked about, Reagan had talked about with Laxalt, he talked about it with other staff about firing Sears. And Reagan concluded that they couldn't fire him after a defeat. That would look like they were blaming him for Iowa when the loss of Iowa was not Sears' fault, but Reagan's. They had decided that they were going to fire Sears after they won New Hampshire. They knew they were going to win New Hampshire. And I think it was the right move. Mike Deaver said afterward, he told me, he said, Ronald Reagan would not have been president if he had not hired Sears, and he wouldn't have been president if he had not fired him. And I think that's actually a measured judgment.
You know something, I remember reading this at the time, that the problem with Sears was that he was not an ideologue. He was not a movement conservative. As you pointed out earlier, he liked looking at numbers, but he was not, you know, he was not a right-winger who believed in a cause. And also I read that he wouldn't let Reagan be Reagan. So he tried to keep him out of the debates to make him, be standoffish.
It had nothing to do with ideology. Reagan wasn't an ideologue either. I mean, look what he did. He hired, as his chief of staff after he was president, James Baker, who had run the campaign not only for Bush, but he'd been the chairman of the campaign for Ford. There is no other example in history, the American history, of a president hiring somebody who'd been chief of staff for his opponent, let alone two opponents.
And he picked Bush as his running mate. Yeah.
Right, but it was what Reagan resented is that Sears had no respect for his intellect. He told, there aren't many secrets in the campaign, and Sears would tell stories that reflected on Reagan, and of course they got back to Reagan.
Well, if John Sears was fired by Reagan, he was also fired by Nixon. What was that? I mean, I know that Sears had battles with John Mitchell and Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And
yeah, he was fired a lot less cleanly by Nixon. He was essentially, he had to read the tea leaves there, but they weren't hard to read. He'd been marginalized by Nixon, and much of it had to do more Haldeman than Ehrlichman, I think. He'd been sidelined, and he was given increasingly less to do, and Sears could read, the handwriting as well as anybody who ever been in the system, and so he left.
But do you remember Leonard Garment thought that Sears was deep throat?
Yeah, which I never thought made any sense at all.
Lou Cannon is the former chief White House correspondent for the Washington Post during the Reagan years, and he's written 5 books on the nation's 40th president. Lou, thanks again.
Thank you, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, since 1972, when presidential primaries began to determine the nominee, what non-incumbent Democrat clinched his or her nomination the earliest? The answer, Al Gore. Bill Clinton's vice president, Gore went over the top to secure the Democratic nomination on March 14, 2000. And the randomly selected winner is Matthew Bond of Nashville, Tennessee. Matthew wins the coveted Political Junkie button. Don't forget, you can always find our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Cause it's easy, like taking candy from a baby.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Russ Feingold is a former 3-term Democratic senator from Wisconsin. Maybe you always thought he had a different first name, McCain Feingold. That was the groundbreaking campaign finance legislation passed by the Senate 19 years ago this week in 2001, named after the sponsors, John McCain, the Republican of Arizona, and Feingold. Officially, it was the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. It curtailed the use of soft money in the financing of elections. It put restrictions on the amount of negative ads that could be run, as well as on independent expenditure groups, the kind that savaged McCain during his run for the presidency against George W. Bush the year before. It was intended to fix the loopholes in funding campaigns that ran amok during the Watergate scandal. The legislation was historic. And it was basically made moot by the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in January of 2010. As for Feingold, his Senate career came to an end later that year, a year in which more money was spent in Wisconsin than ever before in history. And he's here to talk about those sometimes good days. Russ Feingold, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
It's very good to be on. Thanks for asking me.
Well, when you think back to McCain-Feingold, the Senate vote in 2001, and then when the House finally came on board a year later, tell us what the situation was before the legislation and what the bill intended to do.
Well, it was really an amazing thing that we were able to get this done. It was probably the best-known bipartisan bill the last 50 years. And we were working on it for a good 7 years, maybe 8 years, before we got it through and sent it to the Supreme Court. And what people forget is not only was it a bipartisan effort, a true bipartisan effort. I mean, I was very progressive. John was very conservative. But we had other allies from both sides of the aisle. And what people forget is that we actually got this thing through a Republican United States Senate, a Republican House of Representatives, signed by a Republican president and approved by a Supreme Court that had been a majority of which had been appointed by Republicans. And so even though sometimes this issue is more associated with Democrats, this was such a true bipartisan effort that it really is remarkable. And it's sort of something that we need to somehow get back to in our country, because people always didn't understand exactly what we were trying to do. We were primarily trying to close this unlimited soft money loophole that where huge contributions were going to the political parties. But what people knew they liked was that two senators, one Republican, one a Democrat, were not letting anything get in the way, no partisanship, nothing to get in the way of trying to stop the corruption of this system. Sadly, because we were so successful and because we were changing the system in a way that really was reflected in the 2004 and 2006 and 2008 election, the corporate and other wealthy powers in this country engineered the Citizens United decision, which you correctly described. It did not overturn McCain-Feingold. It actually was about the 1907 Tillman Act that barred corporate contributions or corporate spending on campaigns. But it basically gutted the value of what we had done, because so much unlimited money came into the system that it really greatly affected what we had accomplished. So that's where we've been since 2010, unfortunately, and there's an enormous amount that has to be done to bring this campaign finance system under control, because it's essentially in the worst shape it's ever been.
You know, you talked about all those battles, and I remember all those battles in the mid to late 1990s trying to limit the amount and the influence of money in campaigns. And all those times, Republicans, usually led by Mitch McConnell, but they were in the majority in the Senate, would wage a filibuster to keep it from coming up for a vote. And then came the election of 2000, and all things changed. Now, 2000, it was very interesting, because when all was said and done, when all the smoke cleared after 2000, you had 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans.
Yeah, but the Republicans were still in charge. They still had the votes because Dick Cheney would break the tie. So we knew from the beginning of this process, as you've mentioned, we needed 60 votes. We didn't question the fact that that was what we needed in the Senate. Of course, you only needed a majority in the House. And so we just kept getting more and more support every couple of years. The reporters, and maybe you were one of them, would laugh at us at the press conferences and say, when are you guys going to give up? And John McCain would always say, there will be a scandal. There will be a scandal. And in this case, there was, you know, a series of further revelations coming out of the Clinton reelection and others that gave us impetus. But actually what finally put us over the top was one Democratic senator and one Republican senator. It was Maria Cantwell in Washington defeating by a very small margin Slade Gorton of Washington, who was one of our leading opponents. And we actually were able to get the senator from Mississippi, who we never thought would go with us.
Thad Cochran.
We never thought he would come with us. And what happened was just at the time, so we were up to 59, and he walks over to John and says, John, I've just had it with this way of raising money. It disgusts me. And even though he had never been with us, he was a very pleasant man, but he didn't agree with us on anything. He just said, I'm going to help you. And that's how we got the 60 votes. So it was a very dramatic thing. And it was just before the Democrats got the majority, you know, when Jim Jeffords switched parties.
You know, I do remember, when I think of that time, I think of Cochran switching positions after all that time. And that was like one of those dramatic moments where you know, you see them in the movies where somebody just has an awakening. And Thad Cochran was the guy who seemed to change.
It was like Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of moment, you know, in his very mild sort of way. It was a very moving thing, and the way the Senate should work. It isn't working now. It was a very, very touching thing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they always said that limiting campaign spending it was never popular for incumbents. We were hearing that it was like asking chickens to vote for Colonel Sanders.
Exactly.
Yeah. It wasn't in their best interest.
No. And in fact, John and I used to we'd sit out there on the floor every year for days on end, sometimes with my chief of staff, Mary Irvine, and others, and we'd be there. And John, I'd say to John, say, you know, nobody's sitting with me in my weekly lunch because they hate this thing. And John says, you know, same thing for me. I said, well, maybe you and I should just have lunch together because we were sort of pariahs. That you had to drag politicians kicking and screaming because you were literally taking away what Phil Graham used to call the mother's milk of politics, money, the ability to supposedly indirectly, but it wasn't really indirectly, asking people for unlimited contributions that were given directly to the political parties and really actually applied to people's campaigns, even though in my view it was on the edge of being illegal. So people didn't like that. It would mean you'd take away a big power of incumbency to raise that kind of money easily. And there was a lot of tension. In fact, I had some pretty tough fights with colleagues of mine, including Hillary Clinton, over this on a couple of occasions. So, yeah, it was isolating in a good way. Among the public, people loved it, but internally it was difficult.
It had to be. But then I'm thinking, you know, I'm listening to, you know, you and John McCain, and look, both of you were independents. You were, I love this word, mavericks, as Sarah Palin loved to say. But, I mean, you were the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. You were the only Democrat to vote against a motion to dismiss the Clinton impeachment inquiry. You voted, my goodness, you voted to confirm John Ashcroft for attorney general. I mean, if that's not mavericky, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, I was brought up to believe in Wisconsin, although things may have changed some, that people really like to feel like you looked at everything on its merits rather than somebody telling you what you're supposed to do. The spirit of independence, Bill Proxmire and fighting Bob La Follette and others. And so I guess the best compliment I got was when I was able to get reelected in 2004 when George Bush was actually elected president, is that a lot of conservatives said, you know, I voted for you, Russ, because we never know what you're going to do. So, you know, that you would think that wouldn't be a compliment, but it really is in this moment. And so that's the spirit in which we looked at these issues. And frankly, the Patriot Act was the same way. I mean, that was a tough vote, but I looked at this thing and I thought, there's no way it's appropriate for a number of these provisions to be in here. They're not going to be used with regard to terrorism cases. And actually, we're facing the same problem right now. As you know, I've been named president of the American Constitution Society, which is devoted to a progressive view of the law, but also a return of the rule of law. We already are doing programming because we're very worried that this COVID-19 is going to be used to do more government surveillance that may be inappropriate. We're also concerned about the impact on workers' rights and a number of other issues. So whenever you run into one of these moments, that's when you have to be on high alert. And I hope that people will take a moment here in the Senate and in the House to say, wait a minute, this is how you make mistakes when everybody's moving in the same direction and people use legislation they know is going to pass to throw things in there that they really shouldn't. So, yeah, this does remind me of the 9/11, post-9/11 period.
Let me stick with, and now it sounds mundane, the McCain-Feingold for a second, but could you describe the effort to get more senators on board? Because I remember back to McCain-Feingold I'm talking about, because I remember some Democrats fearing that the more compromises that were made, the weaker the bill would get.
Right. No, and that was an interesting series of events. We used a very interesting technique, which I hope doesn't sound disrespectful, but I like to call it the animals go two by two, which our rule was that if you got a new co-sponsor, let's say I got a new Democratic co-sponsor, John and I had a rule that you couldn't bring that person on until you brought on a Republican. So, you know, it was two by two. And we had, you know, great people like Carl Levin, Fred Thompson, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, you know, people that were, you know, really great senators who we had a core group of 10 to 12 people, and we stuck together on all the votes. So that was really the technique that we used to build a coalition that really the Senate couldn't proceed if we would object to something because we were allied, you know, on this issue. But we were also saying, look, you can't use various techniques to destroy this bill because we're going to stick together and you're not going to be able to do anything else. So that's the approach we took, and it's really an effective one.
But when you brought on people like Fred Thompson, did the true believers, or I don't know what else to call it, did you give up more than you wish you had? Or is that what compromise is all about?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, actually, Fred was on board very early. There was a while there it was called McCain-Feingold-Thompson. In fact, Fred accused us that whenever the bill wasn't going well, we called it McCain-Feingold-Thompson. But when it was ever going, when it was going well, we just called it McCain-Feingold. But anyway, he was one of the ones. He led that campaign finance investigation that was a big part of exposing some of this problem.
Al Gore and the Buddhist Temple, right?
That's right, and some of those other issues, $400,000 contribution from an Indonesian gardener, etc. That was going on at the time. But there was, if you will, a compromise near the end that I thought was acceptable in the end. But it was, one of the things we had to do. And that was that, there were a number of, particularly Republicans, but some Democrats saying, look, if you're going to eliminate these unlimited contributions to the parties, you got to let us raise more from individuals. At that time, it was $1,000 a person. So we raised it to $2,000 and put a inflation escalator on there. And so even though that, meant that people could give, a couple could give up to $10,000, it was in return for preventing them from giving $1 million. And so it was a good compromise and not something that gutted the system in any way. So I felt in the end we ended up with a very strong piece of legislation that really did work. And it was working. It did change the system until the Supreme Court interfered with the will of the American people and used a technique to undercut the legislation by overturning the 1907 law signed by Teddy Roosevelt that said people shouldn't be able to use these kind of contributions.
One of John McCain's great heroes, right?
Absolutely. In fact, after one of our press conferences in New York where we had Chris Shays and Marty Meehan, who were our House co-sponsors, the four of us had done a press conference in at the home where Teddy Roosevelt was born because of this. And afterward, John and I got a tour, and I'll tell you, I felt like John was channeling Roosevelt. He felt so inspired by Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, I know that McCain always had the reputation for being tough on his colleagues, but he was also known for his loyalty to his close friends, and he considered you an extremely close friend.
Oh, he was terrific. I mean, yes, he could be very tough. I don't know why, but I think I'm the only senator that never really got in a shouting match with him. We just somehow worked it out. We had a couple of tough moments, but we just clicked. I mean, look, he was older than I was. It was a little bit like being in his platoon, and I was a private, because he was older. And so he would come over to me in the Senate chamber, and he'd say, come on, boy, we're going to Iraq this weekend. I go, John, I can't. I got to go home to Wisconsin. But it was really a very nice relationship. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. He loved to laugh. And so not only in the campaign finance stuff, but also when we went overseas on a couple of trips relating to the military interventions, he and I disagreed on those completely. And so one time we were with the various emirs in Kuwait before we went up to Iraq, and he got to speak first. I was second in seniority. And after he finished, he turns to me and says, Your Excellencies, Your Majesties, this is Senator Feingold. He is a communist. We're totally straight faced. And they just looked at each other, but that's kind of the prank John would pull. So, yes, in the midst of all this political stuff, it is possible to have a respectful and even a fun relationship. And I'm, of course, deeply fortunate to have been able to have that kind of relationship with one of the great Americans, John McCain.
Well, I just want to play a piece of tape that happened. This happened a few weeks after you were defeated for re-election in 2010. This is McCain on the Senate floor.
Without intending it as a commentary on his successor, I have to confess, I think the Senate will be a much poorer place without Russ Feingold in it. I know that in my next term, I will experience fewer occasions of inspiration because of the departure of Russ Feingold, a man whose courage and dedication to the principles that guided his Senate service often inspired me.
Senator, he sounds like he had great affection for you.
Oh, yeah. We got along very well. We just had this ability to resolve disputes. And he was good. He was very friendly toward my staff members, which allowed us to develop not only a good relationship between the two of us, but all our staff members really developed a lot of affection for each other. So it was a real working team. And we had this sense of excitement, but also that it's good to laugh. It's good to have fun. And particularly in a time of this kind of a crisis, it's important to remember that laughter is really, really what oils the whole thing. That keeps people going. And John understood that. And it was such a privilege.
there may be no more McCain-Feingold, and sadly, there's no more John McCain, but I know you're still here fighting, and you talked about the American Constitution Society, so tell me a little bit about the ACS.
The ACS is an organization that's really the only true grassroots progressive legal organization in the United States. We have chapters in over 200 student chapters and 200 law schools, over 50 lawyer chapters, and all kinds of law professors, lawyers, and others who are concerned that we protect and the assault on the rule of law that is occurring at this time, that we have a judiciary that is actually with people who are interested in ruling on the case in front of them rather than having a preordained ideology, and to make sure that the American people feel that their legal system is on the level. The first thing I did on the first day I was working on the job in March is we went straight down to Howard University and met with the student chapter there. And those students there made it clear to me that you can talk about lofty things about courts and about the rule of law, but that you also have to understand for a lot of communities in this country, the law doesn't make them terribly comfortable. The law isn't seen as a support. The law is seen sometimes as a danger because of it not being on the level in some of the contexts they have with it. So we are interested in advancing a sweeping new initiative to make sure that the rule of law in this country is seen as something for everybody and that the system is on the level, that you do not have judges who are chosen because they've already made up their mind. And that's what I'm afraid much of the conservative movement is all about. That should be rejected by all Americans, of course, progressives, but also moderates and many conservatives. And I hope as president of the organization to further the good work of the ACS in doing this in the coming years.
And then I also know you're doing something to fight climate change. It's a group called Campaign for Nature. Tell me about that.
Now, before I was involved with hired for the American Constitution Society, I was asked to help with an effort that has to do with an issue that relates to climate change but is independent, and that is the threat to biodiversity. And I'm continuing to work with this group. Because, as you may have seen in May, the scientists sponsored by the United Nations, like 170 of them, came out with a very alarming report about the loss of biodiversity on the planet to the tune of 1 million species potentially going extinct in the coming years, and really basically saying we could lose our ability to function as human beings on this planet if we don't do something, both with regard to the loss of natural areas on the land and in the oceans and the sea. And so we are working hard to try to have the big conference that's going to be held in this. It's a 10-year goal-setting conference. It's currently scheduled for Kunming, China in October. It may get delayed because of the virus. But in any event, we're trying to push as hard as we can to get every country in the world to commit that by 2030, 30% of the planet will, of natural areas on the planet, of the planet will be natural and protected. So it's called the 30 by 30 commitment. And I've been working to line up, especially African leaders, because that's an area I've worked in, but also internationally. I've been working with the WEIS Foundation, which has funded this through the Campaign for Nature very generously in a way that I think is helping us get people to understand that it is something that makes climate change worse and climate change makes this worse, and that we have to understand that these are twin threats to our future that has to be seriously addressed.
And I assume that I heard a rumor that there's an election coming up, and if that's not one of the top, if not the top issues facing the voters in 2020, and you know, being climate change, that has to be one of the most important issues of the campaign, if not for the future of the planet.
Yeah, I hope it's not just a rumor there's an election coming up.
Well, you like, never know.
God knows these days. But yes, we somehow, even with this, we have to come up with a way to get people to focus on the climate change issue and the biodiversity issue. It would be such a sharp contrast between the presidential candidates. And actually, there is an interconnection because you look at these diseases, the Ebola disease, HIV/AIDS, and this one, which is seen to have been caused probably by the relationship between bats and an animal called a pangolin, which is kind of like a big anteater, that in all of these cases, it is the connection between natural areas and the animals from those areas and human consumption that appears to have started all of these diseases. And so that is all about the environment and our understanding of the science and the environmental principles that go with impact on natural areas.
You know, we talk about the virus and we talk about the fear for the future with the climate. And then we see these questions, will Bernie drop out? It almost seems so, I don't know, there seems to be bigger issues there, but I guess it's at some point we're going to have to decide who the Democrats will nominate and who the running mate will be and how to run against Donald Trump. It's I guess you can't do one without the other, I guess.
The relentless focus on what we all always call the horse race becomes sort of numbing and boring for people after a while, especially when there's such a lopsided situation. And so, you know, I'm worried that there's no attention really being paid to the Democratic candidacy here at all, understandably in a way, but it's damaging to advancing the issues that should be on people's minds. And it's so hard for people to think about anything else right now, but I'm hoping that people are ready to reassert these issues, the ones we've been talking about.
Russ Feingold is a former three-term senator from Wisconsin. Perhaps his greatest accomplishment, at least his most memorable accomplishment in the Senate, was his efforts, along with John McCain, to pass the McCain-Feingold bill, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. It passed 19 years ago this week on April 2nd, 2001. Senator Feingold, it was just great having you on the program.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Invite me back, please.
I will. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
I went walking in the wasted city, started thinking about entropy, smelled the wind from the ruined river, went home to watch TV.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Stay indoors and stay safe. Fluorocarbons in the